I have been thinking much in recent weeks of some old proverbs and some ancient prophecies. Certain dramatic world events have stirred the recollections of them in my mind. I could not help thinking how cogent and relevant and how true and applicable these proverbs and maxims, these prophecies and admonitions long ago were proving themselves in the events which are transpiring today. It seemed to me that only the details in the historical processes of men and nations actually change, only the details. The fundamental laws, the moral rhythm, as it were, the undulation, they remain fairly constant throughout the ages. When I was a boy and studied the sayings of the fathers, the Pirkei Avot, of the rabbis, I was greatly impressed by one of the sayings of Hillel. His words were doubly imposing, first by what they said, and secondly by the ancient and difficult Aramaic in which they were couched. Afu ra'a gulgolet achat shetzafa al pnei hamayim amar la al de'ateif Atifucha Vesof Vetayefaich Yitufun. Hillel saw a skull floating on the surface of the water. When he said to it, because thou drownest them, they have drowned thee. And at last, they that drown thee shall themselves be drowned. At first, these words of Hillel seemed rather harsh, rather pitiless. But since then, and in relation to the events of our present day, I have come to understand that the gentle Hillel was only recording one of those harsh and ungentle facts, inescapable facts, in the conduct of human life, which men forget too soon and recall too late. Hillel was not angry with this poor body which he saw floating upon the water. He was only solemnly and perhaps sorrowfully reflecting upon the inescapable accountability, the relentless sequence of moral retribution from which evildoers never escape. He was restating an axiom of the Bible. They that plow iniquity and sow wickedness will reap the same. Choreshe aven vizure amal yitzeru. The recent fate of Stalin help me to understand the words of Hillel. Now Stalin had caused many skulls to float upon the water. in order to keep himself from being drowned. He carried through bloody purges against his opponents. He slew thousands and caused millions of peasants to perish in order to ensure the success of his program of land collectivization. His chief enemy, Trotsky, himself a ruthless slayer, he hounded to death. He drove him into exile and contrived his assassination in his place of refuge in Mexico. He erased his name. He erased his name. The name of the one man who, together with Lenin, was responsible for the triumph of the October Revolution. He had his name erased from all the records and all the histories of the revolution. The coming generations of Russians must never know that Trotsky ever lived. When I was in Leningrad last summer, I requested my guide to take me to the Smolny Institute. It was the former headquarters of Trotsky, from where he launched the revolution and directed the capture of the city, which was then Petrograd, which was the capital of Russia. There was nothing in or around the Smolny Institute to indicate or even to suggest that Trotsky had ever had anything to do with the revolution. No tablet, no statue, no inscription. And the communists, mind you, are very lavish in their commemorative tributes of the heroes of their revolution. Trotsky had been completely obliterated, sunk like lead in the deep sea. Even his skull no longer floated upon the water. Now, Stalin died while planning for more skulls to float upon the water. And retribution overtook him, but only after his death. His party, which he whipped into supine submission and obedience during his lifetime, his party repudiated him, denounced, and condemned him. His statues, which dotted every town and city in the Soviet Union, his statues have been pulled down. His name is not mentioned now, except derogatively and in hate. And how true then now ring the words of Hillel, because thou drownest others, they have now drowned thee. And how long will it be before the skull of Khrushchev, his former collaborator, and now his detractor, how long will it be before his skull floats upon the water? And how long will it be before they that will drown him will themselves be drowned? When I was young, I read a stern prophecy in the Bible, in the book of Isaiah. It was directed against the king of Babylon. I thought at the time that this prophecy was overwrought. It was a prophetic hyperbole. This was the prophecy. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. Above the stars of God, I will set my throne on high. But you are brought down to Sheol, to the depths of the pit. And those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you. Is this the man who made the earth tremble? Who shook kingdoms? All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb. But you are cast out of your sepulcher, like an abhorred offshoot, like a carcass trodden underfoot, because you have destroyed your land, because you have slain your people. This prophecy I read in the book of Isaiah. And then I read another prophecy in the book of Jeremiah, along the same line, as it were. It was directed not against the king of Babylon, but against Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, who was king of Judah. He had done much evil in his life, and had spilled much innocent blood. So the prophecy read, "They shall not lament for him, saying, Ah, my brother, or Ah, his majesty. With the burial of an ass he shall be buried, dragged and cast forth beyond the gates of Jerusalem." And this prophecy too appeared to me at the time highly colored, an excessive flight of poetic imagination. But today, when I read in the press how Stalin's body was dragged out of the mausoleum in Moscow's Red Square, where he lay in state alongside of Lenin, I had seen the two bodies there recently, lying side by side, embalmed like some Egyptian mummies, the objects of awesome tribute and veneration. How the body of Stalin was dragged out and cast out into some unknown grave. Now his name, which once caused millions to tremble, was everywhere erased, his monuments overthrown and dragged into the dust. Today, I'm inclined to take these ancient prophecies quite literally. I realized that Isaiah and Jeremiah spoke not only to their day, but ours as well. It is true that centuries separate these ancient kings of Babylon and Judah from the red despots of the Kremlin. But the law of retribution applied to them all alike. And this is true of all moral law. Time and place may change, but not the inexorable operation of the moral law. This brings me to the subject of the building of walls. Just the law of the Lord has always been against all those who build walls against their fellow men and cement them with violence and blood. Now some build these hostile walls in the name of race or religion or class. They do it, they assert, they do it for the good of mankind. They're out to save the world. And in the name of civilization, progress, and humanity, they sow hate among men and incite them to bigotry, cruelty, and conflict. They would have you see in their walls bulwarks of justice and ramparts of freedom. Well, there are none of these. There are walls of cruel separation and estrangement, barbed wire barriers, against human progress and brotherhood. Men build walls against other men, not out of love, but out of hate or contempt. And nations build walls against other nations because they're afraid. Men who practice and defend segregation on the ground of race and color either hate their fellow men whose segregation they seek or are disdainful of them. Neither hate nor contempt can be the basis of the good society that mankind is striving to build. We have been reading much in recent months about the wall which the communist East Berliners have erected in the heart of the city of Berlin. And a great deal of passion has been aroused by the erection of this wall, and a great deal of propaganda has engulfed our people in consequence of it. We have been made to believe that the entire free world has been endangered by this act, and hotheads have clamored for military action on our part to force the removal of that wall. Now, actually, the erection of this wall by the Soviet-directed East Berliners was a confession of gross weakness on their part, a tacit admission that the Western expansion of communism, for the present time at least, has ended and its limits definitely reached. If communism were confident of further conquest and expansion in the West in the near future, it would not have built a wall around itself. For some time now, East Berliners have been escaping in large numbers to the West. Free and prosperous West Berlin was proving too great an attraction to the East Berliners. And it was also a daily reminder to the communists that the gross economic lag and inferiority of East Germany were being advertised to the whole world. And communism was thus being discredited. It could not endure, therefore, an open frontier to the West. It needed a protecting wall to shut itself in. You will recall that when China built its Great Wall during the Qin Dynasty, the mightiest barrier ever built by man, the eighth wonder of the world, when China built this Great Wall, it was not in the hope of any further conquest and expansion on its part, but of protecting itself against invasion from the north and the west. China was now content to stay within its protecting wall. And that wall, too, was built by a ruthless dictator, Qin Shi Huangdi, who had turned his back upon the ancient culture and traditions of his country and burnt the Chinese classics, as well as some 500 scholars whom he burnt alive, scholars who dared to criticize his regime. His mighty wall, however, for whose construction he had impressed some 300,000 troops, did not prove effective after all. For the wall was breached time and again, and China was invaded time and again. The Romans, too, you may recall, built in the second century of the Common Era a 70-mile long wall across Britain from the Tyne on the North Sea to Solway Firth on the Irish Sea, built this wall 70 miles long to keep out the threatening mountaineers from the north and the Scots Highland. And this wall too clearly indicated that the era of further Roman expansion was ended. It marked the definite northern limit of the Roman world. And that, in my judgment, is true also of the Berlin Wall. For it should be borne in mind that this wall was built not by the West to protect itself, but by the East. I know that some West Berliners and West Germans generally were very unhappy about the erection of this wall. It must have been an unpleasant and somewhat humiliating experience for them. But then they should have recalled that they, together with their fellow Germans of the East, were energetic wall builders themselves, like so many years ago. I saw sad pictures in the American press of Germans, especially German women, weeping at the sight of this wall. I wondered if these same Germans wept over the Warsaw Ghetto Wall, which their government, a government which they overwhelmingly backed and cheered, had erected, a wall which imprisoned a 500,000 innocent men, women, and children, and consigned them to slow starvation and death. I wonder if these same Germans shed tears over the barbed wire fences charged electrically so as to kill anyone who tried to climb over them, which were erected by their government, by their soldiers, perhaps by themselves, around the unspeakable concentration camps where millions of Jews were herded like cattle, degraded in their humanity in cruel and bottomless infamy, beaten and starved, and finally sent to the gas chambers to be exterminated. I haven't any tears to shed over these Berliners and over the inconvenience which was caused them by the wall which has been built across their city. They are not starving, nor dying, nor doomed, nor facing gas chambers. Berlin is a gay city today, I am told, prosperous and full of life, abounding in theaters and cabarets and nightclubs. No West Berliner has lost his basic human freedom, nor have the Western governments been denied access to West Berlin. I, for one, would not wish to see the world destroyed by atomic fire in order to give these West Berliners, to give them what? The satisfaction of a reunited city of Berlin, which half of Berlin does not want? Or to give West Germans a reunited Germany, which half of Germany does not want? Let these past masters in the demonic art of building walls around other men now learn the difficult art of removing these walls from around themselves. No one will remove these walls for them. We here at home have not been engaged in building walls to divide our cities. But we are being urged to build fallout shelters as a precaution against nuclear bombs, which may rain down upon us in the next war, and the resultant deadly atmospheric contamination. And this has become, this is becoming a major preoccupation of our people. And this too recalls to my mind an ancient prophecy. For the Lord of hosts has a day against all that is proud and lofty, against all that is lifted up and high, against all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and against all the oaks of Bashan, against all the high mountains and against all the lofty hills, against every high tower and against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish and against all the beautiful craft, the Lord has a day. And the haughtiness of man shall be humbled, and the pride of man shall be brought low, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. And the idols shall utterly pass away, and men shall go into the caves of the rocks and the holes of the ground, from before the terror of the Lord and from the glory of his majesty when he arises to terrify the earth. In that day men shall cast forth their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship, to the moles and to the bats, to go into the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs. From before the terror of the Lord and from the glory of his majesty when he arises to terrify the earth. As I look about me and see what is happening to our proud and lofty civilization, how we are being driven underground by fears which have resulted from the evil works of our own hands, I sometimes wonder whether the terror and judgment of God has not finally come upon this generation. The idols which we worship, the idols of silver and gold, of power and greed, of pride and prestige, of weapons and armaments, are finally driving us, cowering, into the holes of the earth, like primitive man into his cave. Now I have no advice to give on the subject of underground dugouts. And I have no blueprints on how to construct the most comfortable fallout shelter with the latest improvements. There are already quite a few samples in the market, and there will be many more as the international tensions continue to mount and manufacturers rush in to capitalize on the increasing apprehensions of our people. And there will be a steadily growing demand for local, state, and national shelter building programs, which may cost our people tens of billions of dollars. And no one will be able to argue successfully against them. After all, Europe built shelters during the Second World War. We did not have to. Our cities were not within the range of enemy bombers. But in the next war, our own cities will be within the range of nuclear missiles, whose destructive force will be 1,000,000 times that of the bombs which were dropped in the last war. What alternative then is there to the building of shelters? Actually, none. And it seems logical, too, that if shelters must be built, they should be built for everyone, rich and poor alike. Why should only the more affluent be spared? I see where people are already discussing the pros and cons of hanging up signs on their private shelters, "Keep out or else," as a clear gesture, as a clear gesture of neighborly love in the day of the thermonuclear holocaust. To such a sorry pass as our civilization come. Such is the bankruptcy of the statesmanship and leadership of the powerful men who have been directing the affairs of our world. And let it never be said that the fault is theirs and not ours. It is theirs and ours. Let us not add the sin of self-righteousness and sanctimoniousness to the desperate crisis which engulfs us all, and for which we are all responsible. What must be done will be done, especially when our government will tell us to do it. But need we have come to this pass? And shall we now be improving the situation one iota by concentrating on a crash shelter building program and by focusing the attention of our people on ways of finding security, a false security in all probability, in a world which will be incinerated in atomic fires, as our Western world surely will be in another war? Should we not rather spend our energies and our thought? Should we not rather rouse the spirits and the passionate indignation of our citizens and of the people throughout the world before it is too late, and direct them in one great popular outcry and in an insistent and clamorous demand upon the political leaders everywhere to make every reasonable concession and compromise? Not surrender, but compromise. And those who are opposed to compromise favor war. Should we rather do that in order to banish nuclear war? No people on earth wants it. And no government should be allowed to retain the nuclear bomb as a threat, a deterrent, or a diplomatic pawn against any other government. Last Tuesday, the Political Committee of the United Nations voted overwhelmingly to outlaw the use of nuclear weapons in war, to outlaw the use of nuclear weapons in war. The United Nations voted that overwhelmingly. The United States and Great Britain voted against it. Why? Because they claimed and said that the threat of Soviet aggression is such that they could not give a blanket pledge never to use atomic weapons. Is that a sufficient reason? And was not another precious opportunity here missed right here and there by the free world? Soviet Union, which had but recently resumed nuclear testing in total disregard of the world's entreaties, the Soviet Union cynically voted for the resolution. And its cynicism was underscored by the statement of its spokesman that the Soviet Union was ready to deal a crushing blow to any aggressor. Can their vote be taken seriously? Thus, the two major powers which really control the situation and which have maintained right along that they must retain the nuclear bomb not only for their own security but to protect the world, which looks to them for protection. Both of these powers have now been told by their so-called warred nations, by the rest of the world, no thank you, we do not want that kind of protection. The whole world wants to banish the threat of nuclear war and all the resultant tensions and fears which drive men and nations to build underground shelters. Russia and the United States stand in the way, each blaming the other for not doing that which they both agree must be done if the world is to be saved from catastrophe. We seem to have entered an era of what you might call calculated semantic befuddlement, where both sides say the same thing and agree to the same thing, but neither means a word of what it says. So I return to the ancient prophecy of Isaiah. Peace will come, if it comes at all, not through competitive atomic stockpiling, not through unavailing military deterrence, not through boring into the earth for refuge and fictitious security. Peace will come to the world only when nations will cast away all the false idols which they have been worshiping, when they will humbly turn to the just ways of reconciliation and mutual toleration, having learned, finally, the greater political realism and the profounder human wisdom, which was revealed long ago to a prophet who stood distraught and disheartened at the entrance to a desolate cave. You heard that great chapter read this morning. The truth of God is not to be found in the great and strong wind which rends the mountains, nor in the earthquake, nor in the fire, but in the still small voice of the heart, in the patient word of friendship and trust and goodwill and accommodation. Not by might and not by military power. Lo bechoach, lo bechayil. Not by might and not by military power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord. When will the statesmen of the earth, who have the fate of mankind in their hands, when will they permit, it may be a very naive question, when will they permit the Spirit of God to take over at their council tables? They've tried everything else. Perhaps the next meeting of the chiefs of states and their foreign ministers should be held not in marble halls, but in some fallout shelter, somewhere in the bowels of the earth, where they will be kept day and night, and if necessary, until all food and drink is gone, and the air becomes foul and their confinement stifling and unbearable. And they shall not be permitted to leave that shelter until a treaty outlawing all nuclear war And the banning of the manufacture and testing of nuclear weapons is finally signed by them. And all existing nuclear bombs are turned over to international control. This is not a serious suggestion I'm making. But do you know of a better one? I don't.